Hey everybody, welcome to the Abbey Lane Beatles podcast. I'm your host, Michael M. I'm so glad you tuned in for my first episode in almost 2 years. Yes, it's been a very long time. You know, I started this podcast as a COVID project, just like hundreds if not thousands of others did. I did it to have a way to focus on something other than the bad things that were going on at the time. And I did it because I had a lot of free time. Now, slowly things started to get back to normal, so unfortunately, that left less time to devote to the podcast. Now, I know some people can put together a podcast fairly quickly, and there's nothing wrong with that. For me personally, though, I like to do my research. I want to be sure that I know what I'm talking about when I present an author and the book that they've worked very hard on. I will not have a guest on my podcast unless I have read their book from the first letter until the last. I just feel it's a disservice to them if you haven't done that. And for me, when a guest agrees to come onto my podcast, this fairly unknown podcast, I'm really honored by it and I want them to have a good experience. Now, when I do read a book of a planned guest, it's a little more complicated than just picking it up and reading it for pleasure. Yes, it's pleasure, but it's also taking very detailed notes so that I know what questions I want to ask. Now, I have had authors tell me that they really like it when the host has actually read the book. So to answer the long time absence is that life got back to normal and the podcast fell by the wayside. But I'm happy to be back with another episode for the time being, and we'll see where it goes from here. I have a great interview for you today. The book today was a real motivator for me to get another episode out because it has two things that I feel very strongly about. The first, it's a female Beatles author. And two, it's a local Beatles author, and I really want to elevate those two things when I can. So today, we're going to be talking about the recently released book by Toronto author Deirdre Kelly called Fashioning the Beatles, The Looks That Shook the World. You know, it sometimes surprises me, even though it shouldn't, of the never-ending topics that can be broken down when we talk about the Beatles. Now, we know there have been thousands of books, and I actually reached out to Beatle friend Joe Wisby of the Beatles Book Podcast, and Joe says it's well past 5,000 books by his estimate. I want to thank Joe for that, and I recommend that you check out his podcast. And of those over 5,000 books, some cover a very specific topic. Deirdre's new book does just that with the Beatles and fashion. Now, right at the beginning of her book, she says that the Beatles didn't set out to be trendsetters, but they dressed to please themselves, and yes, to attract attention. However, they succeeded in making themselves stand out from the crowd to become one of the most culturally significant music bands of all time. Now, I think fans can agree that the Beatles had some incredible looks over the years, and they didn't even have a stylist. I mean, that wasn't a thing. Other than early on, Brian sort of giving them some tips and helping them get that cleaned up suit look, it was them. They decided what they wanted to wear because they wanted to wear it. Now, this book gives some amazing details on the looks, what they were, and where they came from. Now, I personally believe all Beatle fans have a favorite look. That's why it's one of my get to know the Beatles fan questions at the end of my interviews. Now, after you read this book, you may decide you have a different favorite look, or at least you'll know more about the ones that you really like. My guest today is Deirdre Kelly. Deirdre is a Canadian journalist, author, and internationally recognized critic and style writer. She is currently the editor and principal writer at the York University Magazine. She was previously a staff writer at the Globe and Mail from 1985 to 2017, where she was an award-winning dance critic, pop music reviewer, and senior fashion reporter. Her articles have appeared in publications such as Marie Claire, Elle, Vogue, and Critics at Large. She has authored non-fiction books, Paris Times 8, and Ballerina, Sex, Scandal, and Suffering Beyond the Symbol of Perfection. Now, she's here today to discuss her book, so let's get started. Hi, Deirdre. Welcome to the podcast. How are you?
I'm well. How are you today?
I'm really well. I'm so happy to have you join me here for my first episode, and we're coming up on almost 2 years. You know, and as I mentioned in my intro, you know, life got back to normal, and sometimes it's hard to do the things that we want to do. But I'm happy to say that your book really helped give me that kick. I really enjoyed the book, and that's why I wanted to have you here to talk about it.
Well, so thank you. I'm very grateful to hear that and thankful too. Thank you very much. I'm glad it inspired you.
Thank you. So let's get started. So how long have you been a Beatles fan?
I laugh because, geez, I don't know if I've had that asked me, because I think from forever, I have early memories. So I can tell, for instance, I'm 5 years old. I know I'm saying Ringo's name. And I know that I'm dressed in a particular way and hoping that Ringo's going to like my outfit. I know I watched the Beatle cartoons. So that was there. I know that I saw them on television. I heard them on the radio. So this is kind of pre-literary times, you know, when you don't even write things down. So I can fast forward now to age of 10, and I'm listening to a transistor under my pillow at night so my mom wouldn't know. And I remember vividly being completely mesmerized and hooked on I Am the Walrus. It was part of a Beatles tribute show that Chum was doing. So it wasn't that I was hearing it on the charts. And I know from that moment on, I almost see myself in the pillow in the dark with my eyes opening wider and wider and wider. And even though I knew of the Beatles, I don't think I knew that song, of course. And then I'd say the obsession really dug in then from age of 10. So there's now a whole life ahead, you know, manifestations in school, doing all my projects on them when I was able to get away with it, doing my public speaking on them when I was able to get away with it, signing my artwork with, you know, with made up last names that incorporated aspects of Beatles songs. Like Rita McCartney, I had an alias. I was Deirdre Lennon Kelly, you know, but in grade 7, you know. Anyway, so these are sort of early memories, and I never ever gave up on them. And I think with age, rediscovering them all the time, and here we go. Now I've written a book on them, and I never ever thought I'd be able to do so.
That's amazing. So what made you decide to write the book?
Well, I have to give credit to my husband, and I do write that very briefly in the acknowledgments. I am a former staff writer with the Globe and Mail newspaper. I started as a critic in the arts section, and in the year 2000, I was transitioned to the fashion section. If anybody knows about my profession, newsprint surely is disposable. It is true what they say. It's either fish wrap or bird liner, bird cage liner, you know. And at a certain point, I wanted to maybe create something more memorable with my writing. I've written so many articles over the years, that literally thousands upon thousands of bylines. So I started writing books in 2009. I did one then. I did another one in about 4 years later, A History of the Ballerina. And when I was transitioned to the fashion section, that's when I had the idea. I want to write a fashion book again to, in the future, it would be known that one day, you know, people would reflect, oh yeah, that's what she did for a living. But I have to say, I was having a difficult time finding something original to say about fashion. And I was kind of anxious about it. And I was talking it up here at home, and my long-suffering husband making a coffee. He had no escape, and I was just at his back. But I wish I could find a fashion subject. And then just without missing a beat, he turned to me deadpan and said, no, your next book's got to be on the Beatles. And I, you know, hands on hips, like, why? Because you're Beatles obsessed. My answer, yeah, I know, but what could I possibly ever say about the Beatles that's never been said before? And because in a way I wanted to just wrap up the conversation that I alone had started, I just impromptu said, unless, of course, it was on their fashion. And almost before I don't even think I said the whole word fashion. I think I went fashion, you know. And then it was truly an epiphany moment, because I instantly I see myself stopping and going, what did I just say? And prayed to God that nobody had written on the topic before. Went to our wonderful Toronto library system, hunting down books on Beatles style, And there are a lot of books out there on their style as musicians, on their gear, as they call it. And then I did find one book that looked at their fashion, but I will just say it was wanting. And I was very glad of that. Not only were there glaring omissions, but there were errors of fact. And I just really almost wiped my brow in a FU moment and thinking, there's the door wide open for me. Because as I just stated moments ago, what could I possibly ever say about the Beatles that hasn't been said before? And I found something, and it really was fresh and is fresh territory. And actually, that's also what made it definitely not easy to do. There was no precedent.
Yeah.
The research was crazy.
How long did it take you from start to finish?
Yeah.
From that epiphany until publishing?
Okay, great. Just a simple answer, a decade. Now, that wasn't a decade of writing it, researching it. There were lots and lots of gaps in between. I mentioned I was with the Globe and Mail newspaper, so I do have a full-time job. And when I started, so I got that idea. Frankly, I think that was around 2013, 2014, right? And I remember that moment because that was another Beatles anniversary date, 1964, 2014. There was a 50th anniversary screening of A Hard Day's Night here in Toronto. Pierce Hemmingson, Canada's resident Beatles expert, had organized a screening with and had invited the man himself, Mark Lewisohn, you know, the historian of all historians for Beatles fans. And I remember paying a particular attention when I was there and looking at the clothing this time with a little bit more alertness. So in other words, I was just then just thinking about it. I would say that the research was about to start in earnest in 2017 because I organized a trip, a research trip to London, England. And that was all because Leslie Cavendish, the Beatles hairdresser, had just released his memoir. So pardon me for going all over the place here with my answers, but there's so few Beatles people left who were major players in the day. So I didn't actually even know of him. And when I heard about the book, I contacted him. He was most gracious, most kind. And I did say to him, like, dude, I'm coming just for you. So you better make yourself free and don't cancel. So not only did he not cancel, he gave me a 3-hour interview and then invited me back for a second one, during which time then he unloaded basically his Rolodex or, you know, in the phone and put me in touch with all kinds of people who were very important for me to speak to. Now, that could have been, that's when I started writing the book. But as it were, just as I was booking that trip, I got a new job. And so I still had to go through with the research. But when I came home to Toronto, I absolutely had to put everything on ice to concentrate on a new job. I'm an editor of a magazine now in Toronto, and I do most of the writing. So I had to be good and diligent. So long answer, I'll kind of just sum it up, is 10 years, but lots of, let's say, hiatuses along the way. And then maybe I would say that I finally had a draft before pandemic, and then I put it on ice. And then in pandemic, I started looking at it again, and I wanted to redo a lot of it, and it was good to have the distance. So I'd say that the real work was the last 3 years. And I rewrote that sucker so many times.
Yeah.
And just finished that thought as to why nobody told me to, because I didn't even have a publisher. I didn't think, you know, yet what to do with it. But I just knew I had to keep doing it because I thought it was a good idea. And I just kept rewriting it because I wanted to aspire to the Beatles standard. I wanted to definitely do something that would be excellent, or at least aspire to that height. And so that was a kind of built-in challenge for me. And I hope I achieved it, as I want to do them honor and justice.
Oh, absolutely. So you know, you talk about that trip to London. And so this leads actually to another really good question I had is, did you meet a lot of new people in the Beatles community as a result of this?
Absolutely. So starting with Leslie Cavendish, all hail Leslie Cavendish, who then put me in touch with Robert Orbach. And Robert is important because most Beatles fans will remember I was Lord Kitchener's valet. That poster is in A Magical Mystery Tour, but it was also the name of a very popular vintage store of Victoriana, which then became the inspiration for the faux military costumes on the cover of Sgt. Pepper. Paul McCartney has a whole take on that, and I quote him in the book. And as well, Orbach had worked for John Steven, the legendary Glaswegian retailer who ultimately becomes known as the King of Carnaby Street, because he was the one who just started creating a kind of retail mecca on that now most famous London fashion street. And it started with menswear, was very, very much oriented to men. And Orbach happened to be working for him in approximately 1962, 63, just when the Beatles were starting to happen. And he sold them clothes. He had a terrific anecdote. So that was, that, you know, remarkable. I also met John Pierce. Now, I knew of him, but I'd never met him before. He, for your listeners, is the tailor who worked for Granny Takes a Trip, another seminal 1960s boutique on King's Road. Beatles fans will better know him as the tailor who made the paisley shirt seen on the back cover of Revolver. So that was really insightful. And then again, thanks to Leslie Cavendish, I met a 60s fashion collector who, through him, we started a correspondence. And then he put me in touch with people like Marieke Koger of The Fool. And we had an email correspondence. And also with, very importantly for me, this was a late addition, it was Andrea Bustle, who was in the day Mrs. John Criddle. And John Criddle was the owner of Dandy Fashions, which became Apple Tailoring when the Beatles invested in it in mid-1968. And it had never been known before, but it was Andrea who created all those Apple Tailoring suits. It wasn't Criddle at all. He was a front person. I met Edward Sexton, the tailor who created the suits on the cover of Abbey Road. I met Terry Bloxham, former Victoria and Albert Museum curator in stained glass. So you're probably thinking, and? Well, it's that she is the former secretary for the UK Beatles fan club, which was extant till the pandemic. And she was a terrific source for me. I think some of these Beatles people, for instance, who had an interest also in cultural history, they were happy that someone like me was wanting to do this. So they were very generous with their knowledge, with their connections, and wanting to participate in a way in the process of doing the book. So I was very, very grateful. There are other people I'm sure I'm missing. A great friendship that I created. I want to give a shout out to her is Veronica Horwell. She writes for The Guardian newspaper. She is a London-based journalist in fashion, formerly wrote for Vogue magazine. And she is a bona fide London fashion expert. She took me on a walking tour of Soho. I explained everything to me, you know, from the origins in the 18th century right to the present day. So that kind of, you know, feeding me with this kind of knowledge, me, a Canadian who wouldn't know, you know, some of these, let's say, sartorial geographies, that was an indispensable relationship for me.
That's amazing. So how was your research and did you hit any roadblocks?
Oh, yeah. That's why it took so long. Gosh, what to say? I'm going to have to speak in general terms about roadblocks, since that I already referenced it. This is totally new territory. So you couldn't open a book and see what maybe somebody else had said, with the exception, say, of Mark listen and tune in. I actually did avoid looking at his book in the early stages of writing, just because I was dead scared of, you know, lifting, anything from him. And then ultimately I was like, no, go back and lift stuff from him, but just give due credit, because he had some incredible discoveries in there. For instance, he was able to pinpoint the exact day, if not the exact hour, the exact location of what is now known as the Beatles haircut, i.e. in Paris, Hotel de Bonne, you know, John and Paul, John's, you know, famous 21st birthday excursion and to the City of Light, and, you know, that kind of detail. And he also had incredible detail about how they sounded when they played Litherland, you know, which was a very important concert for the Beatles just immediately post Hamburg. And so that helped me recreate the scene, so to speak. So I did go back, you know, to him. But other than that, there was very, very little detail given on fashion. So it was almost to discovering what you didn't know existed. So fashion magazines that I didn't know about that were very much alive in the 60s, but, you know, they're no longer around. Fab 28, things like this. Rave, of course, people have heard about, but I didn't maybe appreciate to what extent they wrote about fashion. So finding copies like Beatles Monthly, here was something here. Everybody who's a Beatles fan knows about that official fanzine, you know, that Brian Epstein organized right at the start in late 62, early 63. But there are no copies of it here in Canada as a complete set. So I couldn't get it through our public library system, but our public library system here in Toronto very kindly found me the closest library, which was Buffalo, New York. So got the car, went down to Buffalo, read every single issue, you know, from the minute the library opened to the minute it closed, and took as many photos as I could with my phone. What else were that? Yeah, things like there were definitely roadblocks. I still have this roadblock. Paul's pink suit, you know, that he's wearing that a lot from late 67 all right through 68. You see it in Mad Day Out. You see it in lots of pictures, in fact. And I don't know where it's from. And for some reason, that one's really obsessed me. Like, where is it from? You know, and I just still don't know where it's from. That's definitely one thing I'm going to ask him when I see him. What else? And then, of course, frustrating that people that I wanted to get to, that happened. One of the Beatles' first tailors, Leslie Cavendish, just gave me his email number, address, and phone number, and did he not die 10 days later? You know, so these were serious obstacles.
So during your research, what was the most interesting thing you discovered?
Sorry.
Again, I'm sure there were many.
Because there's so much. Okay, one off the top of my head was that nobody had written on this before, because that was what was most fascinating to me, is that the clothes in a way were a form of Beatles biography. I couldn't believe, you know, even to myself, it was never just frill, right? It wasn't just camouflage. It wasn't just look at me clothing. It was absolutely integral to their ambition, to their artistic development, to their evolution as a band and as individuals, as from boys to men. It was everything. So I think that that was the most exciting, thrilling, astonishing aspect of my own research, and what really kept me going with it. As I might have intimated, I just didn't even know if it would ever see the light of day. And this just kept me going because I found it interesting. And I am a Beatles fan, and I was discovering things all the time. That said, too, it's kind of related. Sometimes I see myself lifting my head up from my research and going, holy man, like I'm getting dizzy, because the changes in a given year sometimes were just so, so rapid fire. I also thought, okay, this is, again, it's random. I'm probably forgetting things. But when I was looking at A Magical Mystery Tour, right, everybody slags that film. Everyone slags that project. But I think sartorially and from a artistic perspective where the band was going, it was a true period of metamorphosis. And I liked how I kind of came to that realization and appreciation through a study of the look at that time, both what was captured on screen and what you see in outtakes, you know, when the guys are just on the bus and traveling around. All that was happening during that period is a most remarkable period. Most people just think about the Sgt. Pepper right before it, right? But like, yeah, it was really interesting for me.
So here's a difficult question I find with a lot of authors, but I ask them anyways because I think it's an interesting one. What's your favorite part of the book?
I really enjoyed when I did the research just before the Beatles came to North America, 1964, that whole Paris interlude, where I didn't understand that the Beatles were then so attractive, especially to the male Parisians. You often just got a feeling like it was very cold, right? Other write-ups of that time when they're at the Olympia, very cold, cool audience. It kind of went over like a lead balloon. Au contraire. So that was what I found very exciting and thrilling. And I didn't even have that intro to the arrival in North America and the Ed Sullivan Show and the whole hair controversy until kind of late in the day, you know, when and rewrites. And I really did like that. I thought that was original and nobody had that. And it was zippy. And it showed how these English boys, you know, were really impacting what even today is known as the international capital of fashion. I did not know that the Parisian department stores were replicating Beatles looks for their customers. That was very revolutionary to me. They had the Beatles wigs and this whole thing, they call it la mode anglaise, you know, the English style became the style in Paris, all because of the Beatles. So I kind of like that, maybe because that's more recent. And then another thing that was really exciting for me is my final chapter, which again was not always conceived the way it is now in print. I originally just ended it with the Beatles ending. And then I don't even know when and how I thought to bring it right to the present day. And I mean, like, right to the present day. I don't know if you know this. I was writing this book right until March 2023, okay? Like, that was, like, the final period on this, on the sentence. It was just months ago. And when I was doing that last chapter again, like, re-looking at it just before, during the edit process, I wanted to see if there was anything absolutely current that was Beatles. And lo and behold, there you go. January, 1 year ago, Kenzo, celebrated fashion brand, has a white album inspired menswear collection walking down the runway in Paris. And then, of course, we knew about BTS, you know, replicating again Beatles looks for their own success. That's the K-pop sensation. So that was really exciting, though, to see how I've written a history book, but it's definitely not all in the past. What I wanted, so I think I kind of felt proud maybe that's, you're making me say something I hadn't thought of before, but maybe that's what I'm proud of, is that I hope I argued the case that fashion was as important to the Beatles' success as their sound. I think some purists will find that heretical, but I think I definitely demonstrated it. And lots of evidence. And so then I set the ground, but then I show you how so much fashion that we have today in our own closets goes back to these four lads from Liverpool and what they did. I mean, hello, George Harrison jump-starting the acid jeans trend with the movie Help. Like, who knew, right? And you go, no way. And So I hope I'm establishing, their importance and relevance for all of culture. in the 20th and 21st century. How's that?
No, and I agree with you 100%. It's what you've created is definitely a historical document. You've got the Beatles, but you've got that fashion part, which people are going to be referring back to your book for years and years and years to come.
Oh my goodness.
without even realizing it, and it's probably hard to think about it, like you've left your mark. Like people will be referring to this book many years down the road when you and I are no longer around. They'll be like, oh, this great book that was written here. Like, look what they wore, you know, wore in this and wore in that. And this is where it came from. And you're going to get people that are going to want to visit these locations that you talk about where these stores used to be. And so it's wonderful. And you've definitely done an amazing job on that.
Oh, that's so heartwarming and gratifying to know. Thank you.
You're welcome. So some questions I wanted to get into actually in the book, because you had so many interesting things in there. One thing is, and the quote is, shared visual attraction. And you say that without that shared visual attraction, it's unlikely that Paul and John's musical collaboration would have ever happened. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, because the Beatles weren't, and they were the first to admit it, they weren't even really good musicians. They were really into rock music. They gravitated toward it, both of them, all of them, in their own, you know, corners. Before they met each other, music was definitely something they had in common, but fashion was something they all had in common. And they jived first on a level of looks, on style, on personal style, before the music. So when Paul notice John, it's because of the way John dressed as a wannabe teddy boy. When right. John first clapped eyes on McCartney, he really, as he even said, he looked like Elvis. I dug him, you know. So it was like that bromance in a way started because there was a mutual appreciation society on each other's style, rock style, cool style, you know, posing, attitude. George Harrison, Paul's friend, comes into the band. Okay, so there's more with John. He had to turn him on through the music in a way because he was just a kid. His passion for fashion established when he was just a boy, like 14 years old, getting his shirts custom made, you know, when he's the son of a bus driver and they don't have a lot of money. And I think they had an outhouse for a toilet. So you can imagine this just seems like a bit of an extravagance. But this idea of dressing the part was something that the Beatles all had in common. Ringo is, as everyone knows, a late addition to the band. But Ringo had a very deep and noteworthy relationship with fashion from the get-go, because he was the poorest of the Beatles. He was a true teddy boy. I quote him in the book as saying it was either that or get kicked out of you. And teddy boys, you know, they dressed flash and they were very violent. And when the Beatles, the three of them, so their core group was John, Paul, and George, when they were in Hamburg and they laid eyes on Ringo, it was like they noticed the look. You know, and they also noticed that he had at the time a preternaturally gray streak in his hair, and it was slicked back. And they noticed the rings. They noticed everything about his style, and they were attracted to him. And that's how they become buddies, you know. And then the music evolves from there. And then throughout the whole career, though, as the music evolved, so did the fashion sensibility among all of them evolve. And it's not unusual. If once you start looking at the pictures now, after reading the book, you're going to notice they swap each other's clothes all the time. They're wearing each other's clothes all the time. They're getting off on each other's looks all the time. And they're inspired by each other's fashion choices all the time. It's not for nothing that they are often dressing alike when they don't even need to. The fashion was a bond for all of them from the very start.
So, and about that, with the fashion and the influence, you mentioned some of the people that helped influence their look along their, you know, fashion journey, if you will. But I wanted to specifically talk about Astrid Kircher, who even George is quoted as saying, Astrid was totally responsible for our whole image. And this was early on in the Hamburg days. And she is responsible for the Beatles haircut and the influencing of the collarless jackets. How did she do that and where did that all come from?
Yeah, she's so interesting because she was part of a trio of, I'd say, early Beatles fans who chanced upon the Beatles playing in the seedy nightclubs in the Reeperbahn district of Hamburg. So they weren't the usual clientele of gangsters, prostitutes, thugs. They were actually hip young Germans with a real sensibility for continental style, i.e. the French style. And that also went into French philosophy, French berets, dressing head to toe like beatniks in black. And the Beatles definitely noticed them when they first came to the club, but that's not to say that it was a one-way attraction. These three Germans, Astrid, Klaus Voormann, and Jürgen Vollmer, who at the time was Astrid's boyfriend, were very much enthralled by what they saw on the stage and heard on the stage from the Beatles. So a friendship immediately evolved, and it wasn't long after that the Beatles were open to the influence of these German youth, but in particular Astrid, who took a real shine to them and brought them to her home. And I remember reading the Beatles' reaction to her bedroom. Her whole bedroom was all in black, including black wallpaper, black curtains. And I think one of them said, "We'd never seen anything like this in Liverpool." So that dark palette appealed to them. It was edgy. It was hip. She was hip. They wanted to follow her direction. So it starts by dressing head to toe in black. And then the leathers start. She introduces them to shops in Hamburg, the cowboy boots. By the way, the first cowboy boot iteration is from Canada. That was a gift from George Harrison's mother, who on a trip to Ontario brought a pair back to George. George wears them in Hamburg. As I just mentioned, one Beatle wore, all the other Beatles, you know, liked it. So they all wanted something similar. It was Astrid who told them where to go in Hamburg to get replicas of George's boots. So et voila, a look starts gelling. And it is an iconic look, an early Beatles look, the Hamburg look, so-called. And it is that head-to-toe black tough leather. And yes, Astrid was fully responsible for that. You asked about the haircuts and about the collarless jackets. Well, her, I guess her guinea pig, but that is really not the right way to put it because it was her lover and she was deeply in love with him, was an original Beatles member, Stu Sutcliffe. And she was very attracted to him, him to her. They become intimately involved. And she starts, in a way, when I said guinea pig, she just experiments on him. She pushes his hair forward because until then, all the members of the band had it slicked back in the so-called Tony Curtis style. And she has him look almost identical to her. In fact, their faces were very similar. They both had the high cheekbones and the very soft, round eyes. Very pretty, both of them. And there's an image out there of Astrid having coiffed Stuart to look almost exactly like herself. Then she starts putting on Stuart some of her mum's clothes, which included collarless jackets. And I got thinking about that. Well, who was doing collarless jackets for the haute bourgeois? Because Astrid, they were not poor. And that's Coco Chanel, right? If you look at the women's jackets at the time, they're, you know, it was the Chanel look. So I'm thinking that that actually might have been an origin there. So she's got Stu in these clothes, and then the other Beatles giggle at first, but there was a great respect for Stu. And again, what one Beatle's doing, you know, they're kind of open to the suggestion. And then slowly, slowly, this is where John and Paul were open to getting their hair cut. Like how Stu had his. And it was on this trip to Paris. And they looked up Jürgen Vollmer and said, do our hair just like yours. Because that Beatles, so-called Beatles haircut, the precedent is the Nouvelle Vague films from Paris. And then they go back to Liverpool. George Harrison looks at it askance, but it's like, okay. Then he falls into line and et voila, all of them have the so-called haircut, with the exception of Pete Best. And he seemed to be quite stubborn about wanting to change his hairstyle. There are many reasons. Still, no one knows for sure why Pete ultimately got the boot. But I argue that maybe the last straw was that he refused to change his look to conform with what the other Beatles were doing at the time. So when they meet Ringo and replace Pete with Ringo, allegedly among the first things that John said to him, right, you can join the Beatles, but first you have to change your hair. And I make a kind of comment in my book saying that Ringo knew better than to refuse that style direction, because look what happened to Pete. And then I quote Ringo saying, they changed my style completely. So it wasn't just Astrid. Yes, she was a progenitor of a particular period of the Beatles look. But once the Beatles themselves adopt to these new styles, then they become their own inspiration within the band.
So there was a real interesting read for me, and it was a comment by an early promoter of the Beatles named Sam Leach. And he makes this comment, and it's sort of one of these, well, we'll never really know, but it's really interesting what he says. And he says, when you saw them on stage in their leather jackets back in the early days, before they were managed by Epstein, they were the best rock and roll group on the planet. And I thought and was convinced that they would be real big. Unfortunately, Brian took that hard, raw wildness from them and made them more presentable, yes. But that thing they had that was unbelievable, Brian groomed it out of them. So he changed that look from the leather to the mohair suits. And, you know, he clearly feels that that changed them, that they could have been better without that. What do you think about that?
I don't believe it at all. First of all, one thing I tried to be very clear about is that Brian didn't necessarily push them into these suits. It was that he made the suggestion in order for you to kind of get out of the cellar that was the cavern and make it on a bigger stage, which at the time was the new medium of television. You know, you had to be a bit more presentable. And I took a great deal of time and effort to show that the Beatles themselves were into it. They wanted to change. And in fact, that's a theme through their whole career, whether you're looking at the music and or the fashion, is that they never wanted to stay in one place for too long. They didn't want to become conventional in any sense of the word. So even when the leather at the time was seen as rad, well, after a certain period, it was becoming widely imitated. It was becoming a trademark. And they were ready to move on. So just wanted to really emphasize that, yes, by joining Brian Epstein as a kind of a management partner and allowing him to make suggestions only, because they never were told what to do. Nobody could ever tell them what to do. And he knew that, too. And I quote him about that. I just made some suggestions. So they are essentially the same rock band, but they're just in a different, type of grooming. And in fact, I think the proof for me is that very first broadcast that we have, almost among the very first broadcasts we have of the Beatles, and they are in their vests, they're in white shirts, and they're the black tie, and it's on the stage of the cavern. Tell me, like, you just turn your video off and just listen to that. Is that a soft sounding band? No, that is a ripping rock band, you know, and you get a flavor for how raw they still sound, even though they're dressed a little bit more presentably.
So one of the people in the Beatleverse that sometimes doesn't get mentioned a lot is Dougie Millings, who would go on to make over 500 suits. You know, when I read that, over 500 suits in the first several years. Let's talk about Dougie.
Yeah, Dougie is really an important player. In fact, it's great that you want to highlight him. I did think that people did know about him more. And so I'm not sure if it was 500 suits per se, but more 500 looks. They were distinctive looks. But Dougie was on the scene already before the Beatles are making it big. He had already been outfitting other British pop stars on, you know, on the rise, Cliff Richard and the Shadows, for instance. And it was Epstein who did know of him, and he made the suggestion that the Beatles go to Dougie to be outfitted. And this was a bespoke tailoring establishment. It was actually just a few rooms on the upper level of Old Compton Street, right next door practically to a new happening club called the Two Eyes, where there was a miniature stage in the basement where some of the first British rock and roll was being heard and played. So that relationship was no accident, having fashion and rock music almost geographically side by side. I found that very interesting, by the way. So Millings is, as I say, already known as the Tailor to the Stars. That was his nickname when the Beatles showed up. The Beatles allegedly said to him at the first meeting, just don't have us looking like the Shadows. And I think that was John saying that. And they really had no fear of that, because just like with Epstein, you know, Millings himself couldn't tell them what to do. He couldn't tell them what to wear. He had to be completely open. But all tailors are in a way like that. You have to be open to the client and what they're suggesting. And it was the Beatles themselves who were very much in charge of their image, very much knowing what they wanted and what they didn't want. And they came to Millings, and interestingly, they had done their research and they didn't want to be like any of the other bands who were at the time also dressing alike in suits. They wanted to not look like a gimmick. They wanted to look polished. They wanted to look, even though they're playing hard rock and roll, they wanted a very sophisticated look made of luxurious fabrics. That was a dictate from them. Eventually, Dougie helps them realize what becomes another iconic Beatles look post black leathers, and that's the collarless suit. Dougie doesn't originate the idea. In fact, it appears to have come from definitely the Beatles themselves, and maybe more particularly from Paul McCartney and John Lennon, who knew of this collarless look from, you know, Paris. And it was Paul who went across the road, Shaftesbury, to Cecil G., who was an established retailer at the time for Italianate suits from Italy, from the continent, excuse me. And he brought over a replica of the collarless suit that Pierre Cardin had established in 1960, known as the cylinder suit. This was a knockoff. And he asked Dougie to create something around this. I know this happened because Gordon Millings, who is the son of Dougie, is still alive, still with us. And he granted me an interview. And I did just recently meet him in person in London. And he vividly recalls brainstorming sessions between his father and McCartney over this collarless suit. So Millings does create not just that suit, but also the touring outfits that the Beatles are wearing all through 1963 as Beatlemania is rearing its roaring head. He also is outfitting them for their world debut on the Ed Sullivan Show, very tailored suits. But again, with the Beatles telling Dougie they wanted the trousers so, so tight that they almost were impossible to put on. And the Beatles are, of course, supplementing this bespoke tailored look with their own choice of accessories, like what has been now been called the Beatles boot, which was originally a flamenco dancewear boot with a high heel and a pointed toe. And the Beatles had that also modified to their specifications. And they start wearing this unusual footwear for suits in order to elongate their line. So they were going for a slender silhouette at this time, and Dougie very much obliged. He was buying, as I mentioned, luxurious fabrics from places like Holland and Sherry. And he goes on to create their entire wardrobe for A Hard Day's Night. He goes on to create very much original looks for the movie Help, including the Nehru collar jackets, the faux military dress. He helps George Harrison realize a long-held dream to have boots made of corduroy to match his outfits. And this becomes a monochromatic look that becomes very popular among mods at the time. He is designing the Shea Stadium jackets, again, a Nehru style. And then after 65, he's not as involved with the Beatles because the Beatles have moved on. They've gone more in search of looks on the in the boutiques that were then absolutely popping up everywhere in London.
Something that I really like that you mentioned in the book was one of the first articles to attribute their looks to their success. And it was by Maureen Cleave in the Evening Standard on the February 2nd, 1963 issue. And we know Maureen would become a friend of the Beatles over the years. And I'm glad you actually mentioned something positive about Maureen, because I think she gets a bad rap because of the infamous Jesus comment in her interview with John. So, and it's interesting that early on that, you know, they're already, the press is starting to pick up that their look is sort of attributing to who they are. What can you tell me about that?
Yeah. And to be clear, it was Maureen is just, you know, I'm a journalist and people want to blame the journalists. Well, it was that line about Jesus and the Beatles was out of Lennon's mouth, and she was merely the scribe of that. But she was an extremely important journalist in the day in the London papers, and a very intelligent woman, and no wonder the Beatles wanted to befriend her. So I think maybe the question it's making me think, well, that people, even today, they want to know, how come? What was it about the Beatles that was so extraordinary? What made them so extraordinary? We talked at the very start, they weren't even very good musicians at the beginning, right? And they were, in a way, part of a dime a dozen Merseybeat bands, you know, in Liverpool, everybody doing that hard beat. Well, what made them different? And actually, I do argue that it was their look, you know, that they right away were crafting, and I did just mention that they were deliberately tailoring themselves against the competition in order to stand out and for all the right reasons, right? And they had a real sense of taste and style, and they were very curious guys, as Lewison often emphasizes in his own research. They were open to ideas. They were very much plugged into their time as well. I would say that the Beatles, in contrast or comparison to some of the other artists or acts at the time, were much more cosmopolitan in their thinking. Look at, as I said, right away, they were not threatened by these existentialists from Hamburg, you know, sitting in their midst. They were quite turned on by it and wanting to know more. And they weren't that arrogant, even though they were arrogant in a way that helped them with their ambition. But they weren't so arrogant that they closed themselves off to other influences. And I think that that's also, for me, it's still a perpetual element of intrigue. What makes the Beatles fascinating? And I think that Cleave, as a good journalist, and I do that too when I'm writing my articles today, you know, you try to anticipate what the reader wants to know. What might they be thinking? So in a way, you could dovetail it with what's also in your mind. She probably had the big question, what's making them tick? And then she starts exploring all aspects of them and feeding the curiosity also of a larger and growing audience.
Yeah, and it's funny, and as you answer that, I'm trying to sort of think back in my head now, because and trying to answer the own question about what made them start attributing their look to their success. I think a lot of Beatle fans, if they sit back and think about it, your first image of the Beatles for very young people is that visual, not the music.
Exactly.
And for me, now that I'm thinking about it, is seeing those early videos of them rocking the collarless jackets and shaking their head around. And that's what hooked you. And then the music, as you become older, you more appreciate the music. But yeah, it was definitely that look. You know, they were good looking guys. They were always smiling, especially Paul. Like Paul, and even to this day, Paul loves it. He loves being on stage. He loves being out there. And that's him smiling and shaking his head. It's like, this is fantastic. I love this. So I can see how the fashion industry definitely was, you know, wanting to get in on that. So after that, that's the first mention. And we talk about the fashion press really starting to take notice, even so to where a magazine called Boyfriend did a continuing spotlight on the Beatles. Mm-hmm. So what do you think it was, this all of a sudden, this intense coverage by the fashion industry?
I think you mentioned it yourself just now. I find them a very attractive quartet, especially that front line of Paul, John, and George. I keep going back to it. They were almost all the same height. I think George is just slightly like a quarter of an inch shorter, but they're all 5'11", right? And they're all slim. They wear their clothes well. They have each of them a distinctive look. Each of them is very attractive physically. And so they project not just freshness, but I will say, and I'll claim that, you know, but I know others have said it too, but I'm claiming it. They project eroticism. They project, you know, something that's rebellious and chic. When I was doing my research a couple of times, I just said to myself, in a way, this is a good topic because the Beatles are like fashion itself. They're always in pursuit of the new. That's what fashion is, right? You don't wear yesterday's clothes. You're moving all the time forward, or at least trying to do that. You're trying to grasp in a whole new thing. You're trying to reinterpret maybe what even happened before, but you're putting a new spin on it. And Beatles are embodying that in the flesh. They are, yeah, demonstrating that in their presentation, their visual presentation. And fashion as well, fashion magazines, as I just mentioned, they're all about what's new. So the Beatles were the newest, brightest, most happening thing in the land. So it's very smart of the editors at the time to have jumped on that.
You mentioned on a little bit early, and this is about, you know, the Beatles merchandising and people copying things. You talked about how in Paris there was some of these stores that were copying looks. You know, one of the first episodes I did was about Beatle merchandising with Beatle friend Terry Crane, and we discussed a lot of knockoffs, but I had never realized how big the clothing aspect of it was. And how big was the copying and the counterfeiting of Beatles clothes? How big did that get?
It was huge. And you had asked a good question at the beginning. I won't remember the brilliant way you put it, but something that was a discovery was how Brian Epstein himself kind of got his fingers in that pot, that golden pot of Beatles style, and replicating it. Did you realize that those first so-called Beatles sweaters, right? And there's an advertisement. I found it in an Irish program, and it's Brian Epstein's own cousins who are selling these woolen sweaters to Beatles fans, you know,
That's replicating, right. The
black turtleneck look, right? That the Beatles obviously didn't invent black turtlenecks, but they certainly popularized it, popularized them, excuse me. So this idea was maybe just right there is that whatever the Beatles wore almost overnight became the fashion. By dint of their popularity, yes. But even at the beginning, when they're in the Cavern Club and they're putting on those new suits we just talked about, where someone thinks that the rock and roll was washed right out of them when they clean themselves up, and I mentioned I don't agree. Well, other bands started imitating them right then, before they were even outside the cavern. So they were cool, right? They were magnetic. They were, you know, their sound was blistering. They were the band to beat, if you could, and no one has yet done it. So the idea of mimicking them, as they say, was there. And I think with the early bands, it was so that some of the magic might rub off. I think with fans, it is what it is today. When you even wear now a celebrity branded perfume, you want to feel a sense of identity with your idol. And so fashion retailers, fashion manufacturers, once they saw, you know, that this was happening, this was definitely a phenomenon in the making. So that's why, of course, they ran out to start doing knockoffs of the Beatles' looks. I even read something in, it was a history of advertising, that bands like the Beatles, especially bands like the Beatles, was like a godsend for fashion manufacturers. Because I've mentioned earlier, you're wanting to sell your merch. You want something new. Here was something new. And they were evolving their look so often that you were keeping the factories open and running overtime in order to try to keep up with what the Beatles were doing.
Fast forwarding to 1966, touch on about how they would stop wearing the matching outfits that they had done for so long and that they would never return back to that look. Why do you think that was?
I think it was because they stopped touring, right? So this was going to be a whole new chapter in their lives as individuals, but also as a group. I think it's interesting for me to read some people's takes that they think that all the Beatles thought that it was going to end. They especially talk about, or I think even George said, like, that's it, I'm no longer a Beatle, because they stopped touring. But it certainly opened up, as everybody now knows, a whole new chapter, you know, for them. So they didn't, there was no longer the prerequisite of wearing stage clothes. But at the same time, that didn't mean that the Beatles gave up dressing and dressing well and dressing in ways that were still creating a sensation and in ways that people still wanted to know about and were always constantly on the lookout for. What is a Beatle wearing now? What is going to be the next big thing because a Beatle is wearing it? I think that never changed. So they are much more open to new ideas because they are themselves evolving and changing. And as I do argue in the book, the fashion and the music did go hand in hand. So if the music is going in a new direction, i.e. in the studio, and it's involving itself with new technologies and innovations in the studio, I think that the Beatles themselves are wanting to complement that in their everyday lives. You know, so they start frequenting the boutiques. I've said this before, not to take anything away from the innate genius of the Beatles, but there is an element in their story of being born at the right time and being in the right place. Because just as they're coming up, so is British fashion, and so is menswear, by the way. We haven't even touched on that. Prior to the Beatles, menswear was almost like a non-entity. It wasn't something that you wrote about, that you thought about. Designers didn't get trained so much in that other than in the traditions of Savile Row and suit making, right? You didn't do innovative clothing for men. And then all of a sudden, as of like late 50s with John Steven and Bill Green also in that area of Carnaby Street, creating for what was then a homosexual market that then crosses over into the heterosexual market, where you're developing looks for men that are tight, flamboyant, sexual, and sexy. And the Beatles embrace that. And so they make that very much popular. And so it's kind of was just saying, you know, born at the right time, right place, because they then were able to partake in all that was happening around them fashion-wise. And there really was an explosion of new ideas in fashion, large part too, because it's the post-war period. The British government has invested in college education. So no longer just, you know, strictly either become an F.R. Leavis, you know, at Cambridge, or you'd be a factory worker. Now there was more this middle area where you're training more in the art schools, and they're starting to put in fashion programs in the art schools. This is all happening around this time. And these are the new graduates coming out of these schools. Everyone from Barbara Hulanicki, who opens Biba, Mary Quant herself is a fashion school graduate. And they're all starting to open up boutiques and create new looks. And all the Beatles are participating in that because it's part of their scene.
And it's sort of a segue to that. You know, when they stop wearing the matching outfits, there's a great quote by Ringo in the book where he says, "I know a lot of people are saying that John has gone a bit crazy, but all he's doing is not keeping up with the image they have created, and they think he's gone off his head." And I think it's a good quote because, you know, when you love something the way the people love the Beatles, they hated seeing this change, you know, this where they were sort of to be in sync with their fashion. And people had a certain look in their head when it came to them. So when they didn't see it anymore, I know there was a bit of pushback, right?
It's actually apropos something. Okay, I mentioned earlier, I don't know if I did mention, I'm a dance critic. I'm also really invested in dance. And I'm presently reading a biography of the great Nijinsky. And I just came across a line the other day, and I thought exactly this is what the Beatles were doing. And it's perfect that you just brought it up. Because Nijinsky was known for the classical ballet. He's imperial ballet trained, right, under the czars of Russia. That elegance of Giselle and Swan Lake and Sleeping Beauty. But he went against his own image at one point, and he creates these raw, feet turned in, almost people would say ugly ballets, now known as the Rite of Spring, the Afternoon of a Faun, and tennis ballet called Je. And it was because Nijinsky also, he had, you know, his celebrity, but he wanted to break out of that. He wanted to be artistic on his own terms. And he, in a way, risked alienating his audience in order to be true to himself. So when I read that the other day, it's not the first time, but I've always attributed these exact thoughts to the Beatles. And I think John especially was one wanting to just bust through all sorts of restraints ever put upon him. He was most iconoclastic, I think, of all the Beatles. And so, of course, yeah, he wouldn't have wanted to have been made a slave to his image. He wouldn't have wanted to be feeling constrained by the Beatle legend or legacy. So he's taking it always in new directions. He's not the only one. Of course, I always want to tell people Paul McCartney is the original Beatles avant-gardist. Please, everybody know that. George Harrison, it's a deliberate why I opened my book with him, because my research revealed that George, you know, though the youngest of the Beatles, was in a way the most forward leading with the fashion. And of course, Ringo, you know, still rocks it to this day. He's got his own original way of doing things and dressing, and still looks incredible and into his 80s. So I didn't want to just say that it's John who you know, was leading the charge there. But all the Beatles were simpatico to that idea of, let's go forward. Let's not be restricting ourselves to what other people might want from us or think of us. I actually kind of pun it in the book, you know, from the song Please Please Me. I do write that the Beatles dressed to please themselves. You know, they didn't dress to please others. It was an accident, in a way, that they became the biggest trendsetters in the land, because they weren't thinking of how to appeal to the masses in that way, but they did. They just wanted to be great on their own terms.
Yeah. And it's funny how, you know, Ringo makes that quote at the time talking about, you know, they've made a change and everyone thinks, you know, John, and I'm sure they, other people thought they were off the rocker. No, here we are 2024, and the Beatles are still influencing fashion. After the much hyped and loved Get Back, which I think I've watched about a dozen times or so, Japanese designer, and I hope I get this name right, Takiro Mashita, referenced them in his summer spring collection. So let me ask you this question, and this is probably going to be a long-winded answer because I can't imagine how you couldn't. Do you think the Beatles will ever stop influencing the world?
You think it's going to be a long-winded answer? Because it's a one-word answer. No. Now I'll elaborate. How can they, you know, it's 60 years on. In just a few weeks' time, we will have another significant Beatles anniversary. February 9, 1964, when they appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show, you know, blowing people's minds with their so-called long hair, which was more to the point, was longer than what men were accustomed to showing at that time. Their tailored suits, their elongated line, their high-heeled boots, and above all, that pounding beat, the originality of their sound, that kind of visceral reaction that they were getting from, I think, their look combined with the most angelic harmonies. I mean, there's so much to talk about. There's so many tensions, in a way, when you talk about the Beatles. And I think that's what endures, is that it's endlessly fascinating. You can't just figure it out, you know? And so I think that that itself will just keep people always looking and rediscovering them. You know, we all know that even little children today are turned on by them when they discover them. So there's always a new generation of Beatles fans being, in a way, produced every season. And I think that what makes them remarkable also from a style or fashion point of view is that they were, to use a much bandied about word of today, authentic. People often are astonished by this if they don't know about their history, but there were no stylists then. There were no wardrobe gals and makeup people running out and, you know, making sure that you were dressed and looked a certain way. If they went to an awards show, for heaven's sakes, they weren't going to let some designer dress them. They were the Beatles. They were very confident. I used that word earlier, arrogant. They were very confident to the point of arrogant in their sense of themselves as being immune to corruption by outside tastes and people who may have wanted to have made a buck off them. So they just stayed true to themselves, and often they wore clothes that weren't even in fashion. They wore things that they thought looked interesting or that they felt was jiving with the mood of the day. And then it becomes a trend. And as I say, just happenstance because of who they were. So I think it's because it was honest and true. And that will defy time. That will continue to be something to be valued, because it wasn't a gimmick. It wasn't made up. It was a true extension of who the Beatles were as rock artists and very interesting and innovative men.
So I want to move on to some points of interest. They're not so much questions, but just some really cool things that I wanted to highlight in the book that I found interesting. Being a Canadian and from Toronto, I, as you and I have mentioned, we really hold that stuff dear to ourselves, the Canadian and Toronto connections. So, of course, the OPP patch, which everyone knows about, you do mention that. And one thing that was really, really cool to me, actually a couple of different things. One was you talk about the influence on Joe Mimran, who I didn't know until I read this. And I didn't know the name, but I knew Club Monaco, Alfred Sung, and Joe Fresh, which most Canadians have heard of. And he says that after seeing them at the age of 12, he wanted to look like them and became hooked on fashion. And it really makes you think outside of the box of, they just didn't influence musicians. They influenced people that would go on to do fashion.
Absolutely.
And I found that absolutely astounding. Another thing I didn't, and maybe I came across this over the years, but it was a good reminder that Hudson's Bay had Beatle boutiques, which was really interesting. I had no idea. And I loved reading about that. And then this one was really very cool. And I actually went back and looked at the photos after you mentioned this in the book. So the connection is Le Chateau, which any Canadian listening to this will have heard of Le Chateau. So it's a Canadian fashion staple that many of us listeners will know very well. And it has a very cool Beatles connection. The first being that the Beatles shopped there in 1964 after their concert in Montreal. The founder, Herschel Siegel, had sold them, as he quoted, armloads of clothes. He was very pleased about it, and he actually really liked the Beatles after that interaction at the store. So we fast forward, and the second story I will always think of now when I see these photos of the Beatles' last photo session, our last photo shoot. So the story goes that when John was doing his Bed In for Peace campaign, Siegel was visiting John's room, and he offered John and Yoko these unisex jumpsuits, which were a very popular item. And now John would wear this onesie or this unisex jumpsuit in the last photo shoot. And that's so cool to hear that, because I've seen those photos hundreds of times. But then after reading this in your book, and you look at it now and you're like, I can't believe it. There's a Canadian connection right there. So cool.
And you know what? I didn't even know that. I found that out, and I was thrilled. And it took me a long time to get that exclusive interview with Herschel Siegel. And it was very interesting. And John wears that Le Chateau jumpsuit, right, through 1969 when he comes back to Toronto and he stays at Ronnie Hawkins. If you see, look up some of those pictures, there's the jumpsuit again, but he's wearing it with hockey socks and lumberjack shirts, you know, which is appropriate for the Canadian winter.
Yep.
He loved that jumpsuit.
So I'm circling back here because I've got certain points. You know, we talk about sort of the influence. This is a very funny sort of semi-influence story early on, where the Beatles are touring at the time with Tommy Rowe and Chris Montez. And there's a story of how they had joined the tour and they were commanding the charts at the time. So the tour manager had promoted the Beatles as headliners. So Montez protested and he threatened to leave the tour. And then I guess as it goes, he had a sort of glimpse of the future. And apparently by mid-tour, he was wearing his hair like the Beatles, brushed forward and no longer greased back. And I just thought that was very funny.
Me too. I did think that was funny. And I want to maybe toot my horn. That's my original interpretation, because I never saw that anywhere, read that anywhere. I just did that, you know, looking at the images, and then you go, holy smokes, look what he's done mid-tour. So that's definitely revealing.
And then another eureka moment for me is that I had to stumble to my computer and look up these pictures after reading it, which happens so many times. And I'm so thankful for that. I love a book that when I can read through, it makes me want to go look at it, because you can make that connection. I mean, words are words, but you can visually see something. It's very cool. And that was George Harrison's fur coat. He wears it his wedding day.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it makes an appearance years later in the Get Back video. Like, that blows my mind. You look at it and you're like, oh my goodness, that is the same jacket.
That is the coat. Yeah, again, that's what I mean. My research, nobody's had that. I just start like minute analysis of images and then going, hold on, that coat that I'd always seen on Get Back. Hello, it's the Mongolian fur that he's wearing on his wedding day to Patty Boyd. And then I found out he asked it. It was a custom coat from Mary Quant.
So, and another thing that I wanted to point out to my listeners, if we haven't already talked about so many great things about getting the book, is one of the things I really liked in the book, and I think it is worth mentioning, is you talk about the fashions on the album covers in quite detail, some of them, like where the look came from, you know, how they came about it. And that I love, because now, again, it's another thing that I'll always be thinking about. When I look at the album cover, I'm going to be thinking, let me see, what did Deirdre say about that? You know, because now it's there. It's a part of my back thought. So thank you for
thank
that.
You.
That's wonderful.
Thank you
so
much.
I wanted to mention a quote that's in there. And I love that this quote's in here. You know, as being a big Beatles fan, I like other things. We all do. I'm also a big Kiss fan. And you have a quote in there from Gene Simmons, which I love.
Yeah, Kiss. Could you believe that?
Yeah. And he says, they were a cultural force that made it okay to be different. And I think it, visually for me, and maybe you can speak to this and or correct me, is after they stopped the cutesy sort of matching outfits and they became individuals and wore what they wanted to wear, these were the cool Beatles now wearing different things. And you thought, they're cool. We already know they're cool. So if they're doing these looks, it must be cool too. So maybe I can do it, right?
And just to reinforce that, I think I have, I tried very hard to find the Beatles in their own words, talking about fashion, that idea of, so every chapter opens with a direct quote from a Beatle about the fashion. And I think that's one there from Ringo, talking about, well, we dressed in certain ways, like with color, and it made it okay for others to do so too, because people took their direction from them.
Absolutely. Deirdre, it has been absolutely wonderful speaking with you today. It is such a joy. I am going to talk about your book like crazy on the social media, and I really hope everyone goes out and gets this book. I'm going to make sure I put, you know, the links in the description. Fans, listeners, I highly recommend this book because, as I had mentioned, it's for Beatles fans. And that's why I picked it up, because I was a Beatles fan. But it's not just for the Beatles fan. This will be a very useful historical document for people that want to get into fashion, especially the 60s. You talk very much about that 60s look and the stores and how things came across. So even if you took the Beatles stuff away, the fashion content is wonderful. So I'm going to make sure I push this out to everyone as much as possible. So what are you working on? Are you working on anything new? And what do you have planned in the future?
I wish I had something to tell you, but I just did say I only finished the book in March with all the edits, like, you know, getting it ready and getting the photos. And then April, there it is online. I couldn't believe that. And then we went into pre-sale, and then we launched it in end of September. And I've had a wonderful experience promoting the book in Toronto, Vancouver, London, England, New York City. I'm back in New York City February 9 to 11 for Fest, which
absolutely
is this year celebrating its 50th anniversary. And it is coinciding precisely with the dates of the 60th anniversary of the Beatles' arrival in North America. And I've been invited as an author. I've never gone to Fest before. I can't wait. So in other words, there's a long way of saying I'm super busy. I'm not trying to make excuses, but I haven't had a minute to not do anything other than this book. And trust me, that is not a complaint. I don't want it to end. It's like the 1,000 Julys sung about in a certain song. You know, it's just an incredible moment in my life to be able to do this. And I'm relishing it and cherishing it. And I'm very grateful for this opportunity and grateful for people like you wanting to give me a platform. I also do have a day job, and I am a mom with two kids, and I have a husband, and la-di-da-di-da, life goes on. So I'm kind of preoccupied with my Beatles book, with my day job, with my life. And but that doesn't mean I don't have more books in me. I am thinking of some other books for the future. I want to meet with my publisher. I mentioned to you, I am a dance critic. I have thousands of dance reviews that I would love to see put in book form. I'd like to try my hand at fiction. So I have some ideas, but I just don't at the moment want to take away from what I'm doing at present. Thank you, Absolutely. Though, for asking.
Yeah. And I think it's going to be really exciting for people at the fest, the Beatles Fest in New York there. That's one of my goals, is to eventually get there sometime, because of all the people I follow on social media, it looks like a really fun time. I think you're going to have an amazing time. You're going to meet in fandom, I think, one of the best communities. And that's only me speaking to the people that I interact on social media. I think once you see people face to face and you meet some of the amazing authors and these historians and people that just are like the love for Beatles in one room is going to be amazing. So I wish you much success with that appearance.
Thank you.
So before we wrap up, I do a regular segment and it's called Get to Know the Beatles Fan. So it's four questions, not to put you on the spot. So here we go. Who's your favorite Beatle?
I giggle or laugh there because it evolves just like the Beatles evolve. I can tell you in childhood, I loved Ringo. I think all children love Ringo. I evolved in early adolescence to George Harrison. I still think he's gorgeous. I then almost simultaneously was in love with John, his mind, his eccentricity. I told you the clincher for me was I Am the Walrus. I love the wordplay. As I got older, I took Paul McCartney for granted. And then the more I've read on him, the greater my appreciation and respect is for him. He is in the Beatles, I think, the true prodigy. You know, with his instruments, he is one of the best bass players in the world. He is a gorgeous singer, or was in his day. He is undeniably good-looking and charming and always still in the game, never resting on his laurels, creating constantly. For instance, he even did a ballet score to my great delight. You know, a few years ago, he's done oratorio. You know, he's a remarkable gift to the world. So I absolutely did not answer your question. I would say that late in life, too, people have asked me, who do I think is the most stylish Beatle? And I will go back to almost full circle and say Ringo. Now, of course, we don't have the benefit of all the Beatles being with us anymore, but Ringo is still, as I mentioned to you earlier, still rocking it into his 80s. Gosh, you know, he's so cool. He has honed a style that is very much his own. And fashion people are still getting inspiration for him. Not so long ago, American menswear designer John Varvatos selects him to be his model. So I'm not alone in thinking that Ringo is winning the sweepstakes in terms of Beatles style.
All right. And how about a favorite album?
I don't have a favorite album. It's just like saying who's my favorite Beatle. I can't, but I will go back to that seminal moment for me of I Am the Walrus. I was 10 years old. It was the first Beatles album I purchased. Not called I Am the Walrus. It was called Magical Mystery Tour. I Am the Walrus is part of that compilation. And I'd say that that is not often on many people's best Beatles albums lists, but I think it definitely tops mine. There's so much in there to discover. There's a lot of innovation too, with sitar and technology coming in, but you also have incredible anthemic songs like All You Need Is Love. You have also the only instrumental piece that the Beatles, all four of them, contributed to, Flying. You have George Harrison's trippy Blue Jay Way, Fool on the Hill. I really love that album.
So then the next question will probably be equally as difficult. What about favorite song?
Yeah, well, I keep saying it, I Am the Walrus, but that's because, again, it's just locked in memory as something that really turned me on at a young age in a different way, right? Intellectually, artistically, creatively. I don't have a favorite song. I have to say, but at the top of my head, I think, like, if I go to play the White Album, I typically will play Dear Prudence first because I love Paul's bass line. I just love how that builds. I love I'm Only Sleeping. I love Tomorrow Never Knows. I love some of the early pieces by the Beatles. Also, their interpretations, you know, of other people's songs. Money. Yeah, I really am a bit stumped there. I couldn't say what is my favorite. Okay. I love them all.
Absolutely. So the last question, and this was actually one of the first things I thought of in the back of my head when I knew I wanted to talk to you, because of the previous 8 guests that I've asked this question to, doesn't seem as relevant, as important as it is asking you. Favorite Beatles look? And it could be a fashion, a costume, or a time frame.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I have a couple. Again, it's not 100%, but one there where I just go, damn, love it, is when the Beatles are getting the MBE from the Queen, Elizabeth II, at Buckingham Palace, allegedly for having increased sales of British-made corduroy, by the way, so it is a fashion moment. And I absolutely get weak in the knees when I look at the length of their hair, which is fuller and longer than it's been in a way prior to this moment. And it is combined with the most tailored custom suits made of luxurious wool by Dougie Millings. And I mentioned that word before, tension. And this to me is so sexy, is to see the rebelliousness, the anti-establishmentness of that long hair. There's also, they've got all smirks on their face almost. You know, I know that they were pleased, by the way, to get those medals. Again, I want to correct the record. And maybe later when John gives it away, he has his own reasons for wanting to diss it. But yeah, it's that, you know, kind of like inner Beatle. And then it's combined with that elegance of British fashion tradition. I just find that like it's the last word.
So I just want to segue just a couple more points on that question, because again, I mean, the favorite look is definitely a question for you. So 2 more questions, just sort of tagging off of that one question, is what do you think is their most influential look?
Well, I think the masses would right away say the hair, right? Because the Beatles really changed that. I think it's important, a book like mine, in a sense, if I may say it like that, because people are, especially today, if you're not reading up on it and you don't know anything about the Beatles or what happened in the day, you wouldn't even look at them and think they had quote unquote long hair, you know, in 1963-64. But it was outrageous at the time. And I do quote a few men. You mentioned Joe Mimran. There's also, I found a quote from Roger Ebert, you know, the late great American film critic, and Jerry Levitan here in Toronto, how they all just, in a way, they have variations on, I started growing my hair immediately, you know, upon looking at them. Not only was it a badge of cool because the Beatles looked different, but they were going against what was established. They were going against what was deemed acceptable. So I think in general terms, it's allowing the men or encouraging the men to loosen their hair, loosen everything about how they were presenting themselves at the time. So it starts with the hair, but it also, I mentioned Ringo's quote, you know, like we wore color, we wore different things that might be considered outlandish, and it made people think that they could do it too because we were doing it. So the Beatles gave license to everyone to dress as they please. They gave license, especially for the male segment of the population, to dress in expressive ways, even artistic ways. And that courted controversy in the day because it was considered effeminate, you know, because it was crossing over into the women's wear and crossing over into women's fashion, where you dress to be looked at. Prior to this, men were dressing like their fathers. You were dressing in dun colors, drab suits. You looked like your dad when you were 14, you know? And now you could dress in polka dots. You could dress in suedes and crushed velvets and dawn capes and be flamboyant. And all because that's what you wanted to do. So I think you had just mentioned that, you know, Gene Simmons says they made it okay to be different. That's part of it. They opened up the door. So that's in a, and why someone like Anna Sui, a contemporary New York-based fashion designer working today exclusively in women's wear. And I just got the interview with her not quite a year ago, 11 months ago in February, where she told me that she owes her entire career in fashion to the Beatles. Obviously, she's not slavishly imitating looks. She's deriving inspiration from them about the creativity in dress and that being okay. So I didn't maybe pinpoint a specific look other than the hair, you know, that endures. But I think it's kind of like the attitude, the approach to clothing as an extension of your personality and your individual aspirations.
I think you summed it up actually beautifully. Deirdre, this has been absolutely wonderful. Thank you for giving me so much of your time. It's been really great. Again, I recommend everyone go out and get this book. You will not regret it. And I wish you much success moving forward with your career. Thanks, Deirdre. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks for listening today, everyone. I really appreciate it. I'd like to thank Deirdre Kelly for her time. You can find Deirdre on X and Facebook and also her website, DeirdreKelly.com. I'm also going to provide a link to the book Fashioning the Beatles, The Looks That Shook the World. I highly recommend you pick up a copy. And I also provide a link to her two other books, Ballerina, Sex, Scandal, and the Suffering Beyond the Symbol of Perfection, and Paris Times 8, Finding Myself in the City of a Dream. I want to thank everyone for listening. I appreciate it very much. If you have any questions or comments, you can find me on X and Facebook. And you can also email me at abbylanebeatlespodcast@gmail.com. Thanks, everyone. Take care and keep safe.